The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
So a money mule is basically a person that is used, usually witting, but not always, is used by a criminal to sort of be a front man, someone that's going to have a clean record that will carry money for them or have an account for them so that the regulators and the police don't identify illicit activity. So it could be, for example, you know, someone who has a bank account, let's say, just a regular person, but they're given cash from Tony Montana, and then Tony Montana, the drug dealer, tells them what to do with it. So a money mule is that. And it could be someone even just carrying cash. That's another idea. But in the CBDC context, we could imagine just the same thing updated, that now you could have people who are CBDC money mules. They have CBDC wallets. And now it's not just a bank account and it's not just carrying cash. It's carrying potentially dozens or hundreds of wallets, software wallets of CBDC that maybe can be programmed, that can transact in small amounts. And they're doing this on behalf of a criminal entity or criminal enterprise asking them to do it.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 15th, 2020. Yahya Fanusi is a former CIA analyst and an expert on the national security implications of cryptocurrencies. As part of Lawfare's ongoing digital social contract research paper series, he recently published a paper about how central banks are exploring digital currencies, how those currencies might in turn be used by criminals and terrorist groups, and how governments in the private sector should respond. I sat down with Yahya to talk about these and other issues. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 15th. Yahya Fanusi on central bank digital currencies, the threat from money launderers, and how to stop them. Yahya, could you start just by defining what a central bank digital currency, CBDC, is and what its advantages are over regular currency?
So a central bank digital currency, first of all, must be understood that a CBDC, as we call it, can vary. But basically, it is a digitized form of a nation's currency. So the idea is that just like you have a cash, a banknote that, you know, let's say for the US dollar, when you give someone a dollar, its value is redeemable, it's accepted by merchants. There's no dispute in that. The same would go for a digitized version of the US dollar. It would be, in essence, a digital banknote. The thing is, it wouldn't be a physical, you know, a physical bill. So CBDCs are actually currently being explored by a variety of central banks around the world, because even though we have digital payments today, I mean, that's what a lot of people say. They'll say, well, don't we already have digital currency? I'm usually paying online digitally. But the difference is that those types of payments, you know, you're not paying a digital, you're not using a dollar that is digital. You're basically going through a bank, a credit card provider that is obligated to redeem that value. So it gets kind of complicated, but in essence, a CBDC is a digitized form of fiat currency.
So just to make it concrete, if I write you a check or if I pay for something with a credit card, it'll take some amount of time for the financial system to settle that transaction, right?
Yeah.
Whereas by contrast, if I give you $5, in a banknote, I've just given you $5.
Yeah.
And is it right that the CBDC, if I transfer it to you, I have just literally transferred you money? It's not like I have made a promise to ask my financial institution to talk to your financial institution and update your account. Is that one way of putting the difference?
It is. And I have to stress that even when we're defining a CBDC in that way, you know, this for the most part doesn't really exist. That's why you have dozens of central banks that are trying to at least exploring, they're researching how to actually do that digitally. So you alluded to the credit card system or even checks. Basically, the way that we deal with transactions today, even online, it's what you would call an account-based system, right? You have an account at a bank. When you go and pay that credit card, when you use your credit card, right? That company or that bank is settling the transactions, you know, sort of on the back end, right? So when you pay, to you, it's immediate. But in the background, the bank is making sure that your account is debited, another person's account is credited, and all of that is happening. So it's an account-based system. A CBDC would basically eliminate the need for that settling in the background. Because when you present the CBDC, it might be in the form of sort of an app, you know, a digital wallet. Once you present it, it's like that digital asset right then and there is accepted. The transaction is authenticated instantly. And there's not this sort of settling that happens, you know, that usually when we use, you know, credit cards or bank cards, you know, it might take a couple of days. If it's on a weekend, it's not, you know, it's not going to settle until Monday. That's all because it's an account-based system. So CBDCs, many of these projects are trying to get into a more instantaneous form of payment digitally and sort of getting rid of the account-based system. At least that's one format.
And is the immediacy of CBDC transactions, is that the main benefit over our current electronic payment system, or are there other benefits that are causing central banks to look into this?
Yeah, there are a few, and it kind of depends on, you know, which government, you know, which type of central bank, what type of economy. But the immediacy, you could say yes, but I mean, it probably fits more into the general idea of cost savings and efficiency. You know, central banks are eyeing this as a potential, again, they're doing research, but a potential way to have a more efficient monetary policy. So for example, if you have a CBDC that it can go cross borders. Now, there's a lot of friction. I mean, anyone who's done an international wire transfer, international payments, right? There takes, you know, there's much more time that's needed, you know, to settle those transactions. So, yes, one idea is that CBDCs could be more efficient, reduce costs, and also allow for the central bankers and governments in general to have more effective policy, monetary policy. When you think about it, what are they trying to do? You know, all central banks are trying to have price stability. They're trying to understand what's happening with spending in the market and with prices. And when you have cash, you know, it's very difficult to see how that cash is circulating. What's, you know, what's actually happening? Because once it leaves you, it's in the market. Marketplace, but you don't really have insight into it. And so a CBDC theoretically could provide more data. And probably the other thing which is valued by a lot of governments is this idea of financial inclusion. So what do I mean? There are a lot of restrictions now on people often in remote areas, rural areas, poor areas, where they don't have access to bank accounts. Now, this is maybe not a major issue. It's not as big an issue in the United States compared to other nations. But one thought, a lot of these banks are thinking about if you could create this sort of instant digitized currency that you could give people greater access. They could use it in areas where they don't have banks, where they don't have bank branches, and it would sort of include more people in the financial system and give them access to money and capital.
If you had to guess, how close would you say we are from the first set of CBDCs? Is it a 6-month window, a year, 5 years, 10 years? How far down the time horizon do you think we are?
So we are in an exploratory phase, and the exploratory phase is going to let us know how close we are or if we are. And when I say we, it actually depends on which nation you're talking about. So two things, like we actually have two sort of extremes. The Bahamas has actually launched as of, I think, a week or so ago, a form of digital currency, CBDC, that they're piloting and that they're putting out, right? Small economy, it's not going to reverberate within the global economy, but they've been working. They have a more sort of controlled experiment that's happening, and they've launched it. On the other end of the spectrum, you have a country like China. China, the People's Bank of China, their central bank, is in the midst of a major effort to create a digital currency, right, from their central bank, which they are estimating or at least signaling that they want their digital currency to be out by the Winter Olympics, which will be in Beijing in 2022. But even with that, so even though they're sort of telegraphing a two-year time span, if you think about how big the economy is, I mean, there's going to be a long sort of trial and error period, even with that. And then in the middle, you have other countries, even big economies like the US, the UK. The UK in particular is researching this. They may not have a CBDC. A lot of what these governments are doing now is they're saying, look, wow, we see all the benefits. We've seen what Bitcoin did and how Bitcoin has sort of changed the market for digital payments. Now, we're not going to create Bitcoin because we're not going to have some decentralized, you know, anonymous or pseudonymous currency. But how can we use technology and maybe use it to provide some efficiency within the UK system, right? You have that going on. Some economies may decide, it's too risky. We're not going to go all the way to this type of currency. But I would say generally, in the next several years, you're going to see less cash payment, more digital payments, and you're going to see different forms of CBDCs in the, I'd say, the next, you know, five plus years.
You mentioned Bitcoin just now, and I suspect that a lot of our audience has heard of Bitcoin and has heard of blockchain. And I think it might be helpful if you can explain what are the differences in particular between CBDCs and Bitcoin.
Yeah, so, you know, Bitcoin was, you know, or is revolutionary in the sense that it tackled this problem of digital payments where, you know, typically you always need the third party to do this account-based system, right, to settle transactions when you do them online. But Bitcoin is, in essence, it's an open source software protocol that allows anyone to plug into it, you know, anyone to participate into it. It's a decentralized system. It's built by and run by teams of developers. And it's not backed by any particular, you know, currency or asset. It's actually code itself and the trust, you know, if there is, it's sort of a trustless system because you don't have to depend on one person. It's a trustless system that is run on open source software. So that's a key feature. And it's not attached to identity, not attached to a government. CBDCs are sort of taking the idea of a digital payment that could be authenticated online and sort of ripping out, you know, most of the features that we're familiar with, right? The CBDC is not going to be, for the most part, decentralized or is pseudonymous. You know, a central bank is basically saying, look, we just simply want to manage our monetary policy. So let's maybe use some aspects of the Bitcoin system. Maybe we'll use cryptographic signatures for authenticating a token, a digital token or a digital, you know, digital unit, a digital dollar is what we think it is or is sort of confirmed. Well, let's use aspects of this technology and integrate it into our system that's going to be really centralized. It's going to be managed. So we're actually talking about very different things. And a lot, you know, digital people talk about Bitcoin as a digital currency. Yes, you know, you could say that it is, but it's not backed by a particular government or particular asset. A CBDC is going to be that nation's asset. So what China is doing, they're taking their currency and they're simply digitizing it. So it's managed really by the same entity that manages their regular paper currency.
So CBDCs borrow some of the technology from Bitcoin and blockchain, but they're centralized and they're not pseudonymous. So a central bank would be able to force you to attach your real name to your account and to your transactions, if I understand it correctly.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big point. I mean, maybe that's the point that trumps all, because really, since Bitcoin is pseudonymous, right? Anyone can get Bitcoin. And in the system itself, there's no sort of ID built into it. You know, no identification is built into it. A CBDC is going to be a different process. CBDCs are going to have to assign identity or to allow people to access that currency. They're going to have some off-ramp or on-ramp built into the system so that really because of anti-money laundering regulations, they can attest, you know, they can know exactly who's using it. There can be a record. That's just part of the conventional financial system. So CBDCs are not going to dispense of, you know, anti-money laundering regulations like Bitcoin does, right? Bitcoin is not, you know, as the protocol is built, does not necessarily follow the requirements of the financial, you know, the financial regulatory system.
Before we get into the money laundering issue, I do want to mention one additional feature of CBDCs that you write about that I find really interesting, and that's the idea of programmable money. And this is something where there really isn't a conventional analog. And so I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what that means, programmable money, and why might that be a feature? Why might we find that valuable?
Yeah, so programmability. So the idea here is that with a CBDC, if it's built in this way that's, you know, what you know, we called it a digital banknote, right? If it is built where basically that digital currency is in essence just code, right? It's code that allows you to determine this, you know, such and such person has this amount. Because it's code, we're talking about money really as code. What is code? A computer program is simply the ability to write instructions for how something should work, how the program should react and interact with commands. So if you're doing that for your currency, it means that you could potentially write code that inserts the code of that digital currency. So what can you do then? Then a developer, software programmer, can then maybe write new types of programs, like new types of transaction arrangements, new types of arrangements connected to devices. So I'll give you one concrete example. You know, and this actually goes with China. This is something that one of the central bank officials in China said. You know, he had mentioned that with the digital currency that they're developing, you can have digital currency wallets, right? So a little bit different than accounts, because basically what he's saying is you could give a wallet to almost any device, any electronic or digital device could have a CBDC wallet. And so what that means is your car could have its license plate, and attached to that license is a digital wallet. And then all of the transactions related to parking, tolls, highways, right, would be specifically to that wallet. So you could maybe write programs. You could write programs to say when payments can go through or can't go through. You could have maybe dozens or hundreds of wallets for different types of spending that you have within your budget, right? And you could program when those payments happen. I mean, there's a whole host of different ideas or different, you know, programs that you could consider. A lot of these, I mean, I might come up with some, but a lot of this, we don't even know exactly how they're going to develop, because the technology, you know, it hasn't fully been implemented yet. But theoretically, since we're talking about programming, you know, creating a token that's digital code, in essence, yes, you could program it. And you could even, I mean, I can talk too about the idea of micropayments. You know, so think about this. If I'm just working with my regular currency today in the US, how possible is it for me to sell or donate half a penny? It's impossible. I can't pay half a cent or, you know, 1/5 of one penny at all. It's not possible. We can't divide up our money into smaller units, right? Well, with a CBDC, since we're really talking about code, this is where we get the influence of Bitcoin, because a Bitcoin, there's one Bitcoin, but you can divide a Bitcoin into 0.0000, you know, and beyond decimal points, right? Because all it is code. So theoretically, a CBDC built in this manner would then allow for micropayments, microtransactions, for you to sell or to transact in units smaller than one penny. Maybe you have a website and people can donate for each, or people can, you know, pay for each article that they read 0.001 cent. And that's how you sort of calculate how much that site earns. This is stuff that's not possible with our regular money today, but a CBDC would enable it.
So we've talked about a lot of the good features of digital currencies and CBDCs. So now let's turn to the risks. And before we get into the specific issue of money laundering in the CBDC context, I was hoping you could just talk a little bit about what money laundering is in general. Well, what are some of the main ways that governments and private entities fight against it today?
Money laundering is the act of getting illicit funds, so funds gained through illicit activity or funds that are have been raised to support illicit, illegal means, right? So we're talking about illegal drug sales. We're talking about child exploitation, you know, payments for child exploitation and human smuggling. You're talking about terrorist financing and even weapons proliferation, right? A nuclear proliferation. These are all parts of illicit finance. And so money laundering is when folks are involved in that activity, they need a way to use that money. So if it's, let's say, ill-gotten gains from, let's say, hacking some sort of ransomware attack, those illicit actors want to find a way to make that money appear that it is clean, quote unquote. So there are lots of techniques. I mean, this is something that criminals have been doing for generations, right? Taking illicit money and then disguising it or cleaning it. And there are lots of different ways to do that, right? To try to obfuscate the origin of illicit funds by using front companies, by using, you know, people that are going to pretend to just be regular people that don't have ties to, you know, like a money laundering. I mean, basically name your favorite TV show about money laundering, whether it's Breaking Bad or, you know, The Sopranos or something, you know, or even The Wire, right? Criminal enterprises have to have a way to get that illicit money into the traditional banking system. And so they often love cash because it's anonymous. So if someone brings cash, a bunch of cash, and puts it into a bank account, the bank does not know, well, oh, this cash definitely came from drug sales, right? There's no record. So, you know, to your point about, well, how have governments addressed this? Well, that's where you have checks into who uses a bank account, monitoring of the behavior. So if let's say, or even restrictions. So for example, in the U.S., you know, if there's a transaction of $10,000 of cash coming into a bank account, that bank is required to file a report that, look, this much cash came in. It came in from this person. Why? Why is that requirement? The requirement is to put a little bit of scrutiny on cash transactions, which often can be illicit or illegal. So this is, you know, the perfect example is, you know, if you think about sort of like the Miami Vice days, right? The old days, a guy could come in the early 80s, come into a bank account, bring a briefcase full of cash and say, oh, you know, I'm John Smith. I'd like to deposit this, you know, $10,000 or $50,000 worth of cash. And the teller would say, okay, Mr. Smith, yeah, sure. We'll deposit your money. No questions asked. That's actually how things were happening in, you know, the early 80s. By the early 90s, the global banking system and governments decided that, maybe we should have some checks and balances. We should have ID identification checks, what they call know your customer. If your bank, know actually who you're banking with, they have to provide IDs. And of course, this expanded after 9/11 because of the issue of terrorist financing. So this is how the financial system is, where anonymity is disliked. And knowing as much as you can about the person using your bank and using your credit card is paramount.
So now let's turn to CBDCs in particular. As you point out in your paper, in some ways, in particular, the fact that CBDCs require actual identity, they can't be run pseudonymously, or at least central banks can decide to require actual identity. It does seem in that sense that CBDCs are actually much less attractive to criminals or would-be money launderers, because presumably it's harder to do money laundering with CBDCs. So why is it that criminals are still going to try to launder CBDCs if the risks to them are higher relative to, let's say, just laundering cash?
Well, Alan, this is where you get to the reason I wrote this paper. Because in the sort of superficial policy discussion around CBDCs and money laundering, what I was reading and hearing, even from some of the central banks, was just a pretty simplistic statement of CBDCs will require identification for people to use, therefore there won't be so many risks for illicit use. And on the surface, that is true. If I'm going to compare, if I'm a criminal, I'm Mr. Tony Montana, I'm a criminal. If I have a choice between transacting in cold hard cash, which is totally anonymous, and a CBDC, where I've got to register my name to use it, obviously I'm going to choose cash. So in that way, yes, for illicit activity, cash is better. So CBDCs, one would say, yeah, that's gonna deter some illicit use. But that's just sort of the first order. And this is where you get to, you know, my experience, I always say at heart, I'm still an intelligence analyst, you know, from my time working in the intelligence community. And one of the things that we would often have to do is when we were thinking about illicit actors, whether it was terrorist plotting or whatever, you know, we would have analytic techniques. We would think about, you know, how would this illicit actor respond? Or what's like a worst case scenario? What's, you know, high impact, low probability scenario that could happen? And so what I did was I said, okay, so let's say we have the CBDC that has greater identification built into it. Don't I think that criminals are still going to want to use it? So if I'm Tony Montana, you know, drug dealer, maybe I'm going to use cash because that's going to be the most anonymous. But at the end of the day, CBDCs are going to have so many great features that illicit actors are going to still want to use it. They're going to basically want to launder. This was my thinking, right? You know, they're going to want to get into the CBDCs because CBDCs have programmability, have the ability to be paid digitally across borders quickly, which you can't do with cash, the ability to create all types of different wallets and transactions, different types of arrangements. So there's still going to be some sort of pull. And that's where we focus the paper on, okay, given the anti-money laundering constraints that are going to be built in the system, what do we think are ways that money launderers are going to try to get into the CBD system so they still can use it?
So in your paper, you point out four, I don't know, call them factors or techniques, but four ways that criminals could money launder CBDCs. And so I'm just going to list them, and then I'm going to ask you to go through each of them briefly and just describe them in a little bit more detail. The first are money mules. The second are winning merchants. The third is the factor you mentioned of the ease of cross-border transactions. And the fourth factor you mentioned is the existence of crypto asset exchanges that don't comply with anti-money laundering regulations. So let's start at the top. And can you just define what money mules are and what that would look like in the CBDC context?
Sure. And let me give some context even before I jump into that, Alan, because the idea here is that the criminals are going to exploit CBDCs in two different ways. One, they're going to exploit that there will be new functionality that we've kind of touched on, but they're also going to exploit the fact that there are already longstanding illicit finance, you know, methodologies that are out there. And so a good example is money mules, right? But this is going to be updated. So a money mule is basically a person that is used, usually winning, but not always, is used by a criminal to sort of be a front man, someone that's going to have a clean record that will carry money for them or have an account for them so that the regulators and the police don't identify illicit activity. So it could be, for example, you know, someone who has a bank account, let's say, just a regular person, but they're given cash from Tony Montana. And then Tony Montana, the drug dealer, tells them what to do with it. So he tells the person, hey, you send this money, put it in your account, and then send it to this account over there, or you know, do whatever. So a money mule is that. And it could be someone even just carrying cash. That's another idea. But in the CBDC context, we could imagine just the same thing updated, that now you could have people who are CBDC money mules. They have CBDC wallets. And now it's not just a bank account and it's not just carrying cash. It's carrying potentially dozens or hundreds of wallets, software wallets of CBDC that maybe could be programmed, that can transact in small amounts. And they're doing this on behalf of a criminal entity or criminal enterprise asking to do it.
So that's money mules. In the paper, you also talk about a specific form of money mules, as I understand it, a subtype that you call winning merchants. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that next.
Yeah, and it's a money mule, but it has to be emphasized because the idea here is that you're probably going to have, in a CBDC-rich economy, merchants, people who are vendors, who are selling, whether they're stores or whatever, but who are money mules on behalf of criminal enterprises. And the reason why sort of this is an important subcategory is because a merchant, by the nature of them being involved in business and receiving payments, it's going to be potentially easier for them to obfuscate the money trail, right? If I'm a merchant and I'm already, you know, earning CBDCs and I'm sending out CBDCs, you know, it's just like a laundromat, right? That has a lot of transactions. It's relatively easy to mix money around. So if you're receiving, you could just basically pretend someone is your customer. They're not a real customer. They're Tony Montana giving you some of his drug money, and then you turning it around in a CBDC and sending it to your bank or sending it to another person. So merchants are going to be key, because in CBDCs, now we're talking about a world where digital transactions would be expanded, will have more functionality, and there will probably be new types of businesses, maybe even connected with Internet of Things devices, transacting in CBDC, and an illicit actor, drug dealer, even a terrorist financer, may use folks involved in that to obfuscate their financial trail.
The next thing I want to mention is the issue of cross-border transactions. And so I was hoping you could talk a little bit about why that's important or useful for money launderers as a general matter, and then in particular, why CBDCs facilitate cross-border transactions in a way that, whether it's physical cash or our current electronic payment system, does not.
Well, here the idea is, you know, the CBDCs minimize friction. And what I mean is, when you're having cross-border international transactions, when we talked about the bank accounts, you know, scenario, right? There's going from one bank to another bank in another country. There's all types of settling that has to happen. It adds to time, adds to maybe scrutiny, and even think about cash. So this is an example I like to put out there. If I'm a, you know, I don't know, sanctions buster, if I'm North Korea or, you know, someone's trying to proliferate nuclear weapons, and I want to move $100 million worth of cash, and I want to do it across border, there's going to be a lot. I'm going to need pallets of cash. I'm going to need a plane. I'm going to need our trucks to go across the border. I'm going to have to pay off border guards, right? That's a huge, huge enterprise when you talk about bulk cash. For an international transaction, go across borders. So with CBDCs, we're talking about a more streamlined version. Now, if you're able to move millions of dollars digitally, that changes the game, or at least it brings some risk, because for the criminal who's paying across borders, you know, that criminal now doesn't have to take that same risk of moving physical cash and doesn't have the same issue. If things are digitally swapped between currencies across borders and there's less of an intensive process, it just makes moving across borders easier. And that's maybe advantageous for regular customers and for central banks, but it's also advantageous for illicit actors.
Another point you make in your paper is that CBDCs are not going to displace other forms of cryptocurrencies, whether it's Bitcoin or something else. And therefore, you're going to have this proliferation of crypto asset exchanges online, and that the existence of some of these exchanges, and especially ones that don't follow anti-money laundering requirements, is going to be a continuing problem. And so I'm curious if you could explain how CBDCs interact with other crypto assets and other crypto asset exchanges online.
Well, I have to add the sort of caveat that, you know, it's all going to depend on how CBDCs are managed with exchanges and how they're allowed to be exchanged. But the key point to take home is that whatever protections you put into, you central banker or regulator put into the CBDC purchasing process, on-ramp process, the illicit activity that's already happening with exchanges where people get Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, that's still going to be there, and it's going to be there for other people to exploit. And so today we have lots of exchanges where people can go and buy, let's say, Bitcoin and not provide ID. You know, there are those ways to get them, especially in countries where maybe they don't have strong regulations. And so you still have markets where people are on the dark web and they're, you know, buying goods or they're doing illicit activity and they're using cryptocurrencies from these exchanges. So the fact that you have this and you're going to continue to have this is that that's going to be a tool within the toolkit for illicit actors. And it means that, for example, if exchanges that sell cryptocurrencies are also going to be allowed to sell CBDCs, now you have one marketplace where people can switch in between. And if you have that ability, right, if this exchange can also give you Bitcoin as well as CBDC, the CBDC dollar, then you have to now account for illicit Bitcoin perhaps making its way onto the platform and then translating or transferring into CBDC. So, I mean, the whole point is that where there are markets to move illicit cryptocurrencies, you know, there's going to be some convergence and there's going to be at least the ability for people to try to mix that stuff in to CBDCs. And once they get in CBDC, then they can, it may seem legitimate and they can use it in the regular financial system.
One great feature about your paper, and unfortunately, we're not going to have time to get into it on this conversation, but I hope our audience gets a chance to read the paper when it comes out, is the range of case studies that you provide about how this could all work out in practice. And one thing I really appreciate that is that you really show that this is not just a problem for what we might think of as the kind of classic money laundering scenario. You mentioned The Sopranos. That's also where my head goes whenever I hear money laundering, right? That it's not just criminals and drug lords, but that terrorist financing is a really big issue. And equally important are nations that are trying to evade sanctions for weapons proliferation or other reasons. So I really urge folks to read the paper and look at these case studies. But what I wanted to turn to at the end of our discussion here is, so CBDCs are obviously super valuable and they can create a lot of value and opportunity for financial innovation. And they're also clearly quite risky for all the reasons that you just described. So how do we fight this? How do we fight the potential dangers that come with CBDCs while still preserving their capabilities? And I was hoping you could start by talking about what you think the role of government is here and what are the sort of concrete steps that governments can take, whether now in preparing for CBDCs or once they're released, to mitigate the risk of money laundering?
I would say you could look at it tactically and strategically. So, I mean, on the tactical level, there are a number of things which really aren't that different than what we already do, but it's more like updating them for the CBDC context. And so, you know, one of the key things is, you know, you have transaction monitoring. And one of the things, you know, we didn't talk about is the way that CBDCs are being discussed as being distributed. Typically, the idea is not that the central banks want to immediately just or directly give people CBDCs. Most of these models, most of this research is looking at the idea of like a third party, a bank or some sort of payment provider being the entity that people get their CBDCs from. So if that's going to be the case, then these entities are going to have to monitor. They're going to have to continue to sort of, you know, do background checks on you know, the suspicious activity that they're going to be able to see, right? Because banks today, they have transaction monitoring. They look for patterns of behavior. So we don't need to go into all of those, but you know, tactically, that's going to have to be updated for CBDC because CBDCs are going to have more or different interactions than, you know, just typical regular payments, right? So that's one side of it. But another side of it is, you know, one, sort of seeing CBDCs broadly in the sort of national illicit finance strategy. In particular, I'm thinking from the U.S. perspective, right? My sense is that the U.S. government often is sort of running behind a lot of these innovations. And so the U.S. doesn't have a CBDC. It's not clear, you know, when or if, you know, the U.S. is going to create one. Maybe it won't. But the fact that others are creating them, we're going to eventually deal with them. So the U.S. needs to be thinking strategically about these potential scenarios and be sort of assessing these potential developments. But then the other side of it is even the industry itself. If a CBDC in a country like the U.S. or even the U.K. Or elsewhere is launched, when they're launched, there's going to be a whole new type of industry that comes out, the financial technology industry, because you're going to have providers providing the software, providing the payment interfaces. So one of the key takeaways is that that industry is going to have to, I would even say, potentially have even more scrutiny than some of our current payment players because of the greater functionality. So, you know, that's one of the things. There's going to have to be very, I'd say, rigorous standards for the players that get involved in CBDC payments and facilitating this type of activity. And so, but the last thing I would say is, you know, because we're in the early stages, you know, I recommend that there's going to have to be greater, for lack of a better term, sort of public-private partnership on how CBDCs, you know, should, how they should look, how they should be run, because the illicit activity that's going to arise is really going to be based on, you know, whatever standards countries set. So there's going to have to be sort of a longer discussion, even, you know, on a society basis about how to deal with privacy. You know, we didn't talk that much about that, but that's going to be a consideration. The cybersecurity risk, which we don't have time to go into, but that's obviously critically important. So before these types of currencies are launched, there's going to have to be additional, I would say, study and assessment of these types of risks.
Yaya, thanks so much for talking about this piece. It's really terrific. And again, I hope and encourage our listeners to take a look at it.
Thank you, Alan. It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you've liked what you've heard, please take a moment to rate the podcast or let someone know so they can enjoy it as well. This podcast is produced by Jen Patya Howell. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.